Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Price Transparency: What Labs Need to Know Now About Existing Regulations and Pending Legislation. The presenters are Rochelle Gallant, Chief Strategy Officer, Caravizo, Falls Church, Virginia; Christopher Ho, MS, SVP Customer Operations Group, Myriad Genetics, Salt Lake City, Utah; and Gregory Stein, Founder and CEO, Shadowbox, Carlsbad, California.
Thank you very much, Richard, and thanks everyone for kicking off your EWC 24 with us this morning. I know there are several sessions happening at the same time, and all of them seem very interesting. So we're very grateful that you have agreed to start with us. So my name's Greg Stein. I am the CEO and founder of a company called Shadowbox. And with me is Christopher Ho, who's a Senior Vice President of Commercial Operations at Myriad Genetics, and Rachel Gallant, who is Chief Strategy Officer for Caravizo. We will spend a little bit more time going over our bios, but I thought it would be good just to jump into what our learning objectives are for today. So even though I have these up on the board and we all confirmed that you can see them with the lights on, I think there really is one overriding takeaway that I would put on top of this, which is reflective not only of what we're talking about here in this session, but really a focus of this this meeting throughout. With the FDA pre-publishing its final rule on LDT regulation yesterday, with PAMA, with all of the rules and regulations and laws and legislation that we as lab operators, owners, vendors, et cetera, are faced with, I think the overriding message that I want you to take away, and hopefully my colleagues would agree, is that it's important for you to be informed, and it's important for you to be aware, and it's incredibly important for you to be involved. You cannot rely on ACLA in Congress to have your back all the time. They are outgunned. They're outgunned by the AHA, the AHIP, the AMA. And so when there is discussion at the federal level or in the state houses about laws, rules, and regulations, it's incredibly important that you are talking as individual companies and individuals who are affected to your congressional staff, to the congressional members, to your state house folks, and show them specifically how these rules might affect you. And then, of course, in order to do that, you have to be informed. To that point, I have some cards here. There is a lab fly-in being organized for the first week of June to have folks from labs go out and actually talk to their members of Congress. If you want for more information on it, this is specifically related to the FDA regulation of LDTs. This group is interested in seeing CLIA modifications as a better solution for labs versus perhaps valid, if you're familiar with that, or certainly what FDA's put out. There will be a lot more discussion about the FDA rule, obviously, today. But anyways, I want to make sure that that is the overriding takeaway, is to be involved and be aware, and that's the purpose of this conversation. In terms of our agenda, we are going to give you a little bit of history, which I'm sure is intuitive to most of you, but we think it helps set the table. We will talk about the NSA, the No Surprise Act, and other legislative initiatives that are current and ongoing and proposed. We will then turn it over to Myriad Genetics and talk about how one of the premier independent labs is actually managing and dealing with price transparency and these rules and regulations. And then we're going to bring it all back and circle back as to how labs are currently attempting to comply and how they might attempt to comply as these rules and regulations continue to promulgate. Okay, so enough of the intro. Let's do a little bit of background. So why don't we start, Rachel, with you, provide a little bit of context.
Sure. Good morning. My name is Rachel Gallant, and I began my career in pharmaceuticals on the engineering and manufacturing side. And I went over into the commercial business and did a stint in marketing. And one of my last roles in pharma was on the global side, where I saw healthcare at a global level. And I started thinking, oh my goodness, the U.S. is so complicated. We need to help patients and make it a little bit easier to navigate. And that brought me over to CareVizzo, who at the time was known as CMT Solutions, and was really helping patients with prior authorizations, physician-directed for the laboratories. And being outside of D.C., we started to hear more and more about price transparency in healthcare legislation, and that led us to kind of developing more along the lines of a price transparency tool so to better give patients an idea of what their healthcare was going to cost in advance.
So before I move to Chris, I just want to clarify, you are not an attorney.
I'm not an attorney, no. No.
All right, just checking. All right, Chris.
I'm not an attorney either. My name is Chris Ho. I'm the SVP of Customer Operations Group at Myriad. My background's in genetics and worked clinically as a genetic counselor for a number of years. I've been with Myriad for now 24 years in various capacities. My current role in Customer Operations Group, I lead our revenue cycle team, as well as our payer markets team, so responsible for all coverage and contracting for our portfolio of products. Excited to be here.
Thanks, both. And I'm glad you both said you're not attorneys. I'm not an attorney either. So this is a disclaimer. We are not providing legal advice. Our objective here today is to give you information as experienced laymen in the field. If there are questions, which I imagine we will provide enough information to generate more questions than we will be able to answer, but hopefully it will give you enough information you can take back to your counsel and your compliance officers to really dig into these things and make sure that your lab is aware and complying. My background, although I was previously with a large independent lab serving also in a strategy role, I wasn't always in the lab space or even in healthcare, unlike these folks whose careers are there. I actually started my career as a legislative staffer on Capitol Hill. And so I worked for a couple members of Congress helping write laws. And as I helped write those laws and watch the agencies write the implementing rules and then see how individuals and companies and society attempted to deal with those rules, it gave me a bit of a perspective that sometimes the good intentions, maybe more than sometimes the good intentions that happen on the front end, result in a lot of hard work and the implementation process. And so that's hopefully going to inform our conversations today. All right, so with some background, how we got here. So back in the day, not too long ago, but thinking 60s, 70s, 80s, as you know, health insurance was primarily covered by employers, and the portion that was not covered in terms of was a fairly light load. Now, I'm not saying it was inexpensive, but it certainly was not evident what the true cost of care was for patients. However, many macro trends were occurring, including, and probably most important, the aging population. So as the population of folks grew in terms of living longer and needing greater care, and the proportion of folks who were younger and not needing care didn't keep up in terms of numbers, the exponential cost of care put a lot of pressure on the payers to try and shift some of those burdens in terms of that cost elsewhere. And so that's when we started to see employers pushing more and more of the cost onto their employees. We saw, as a result, high deductible plans start to appear to try and reduce the upfront cost for patients who weren't able to cover the cost of those premium increases. And that led to things like what Congress at the time thought were pretty good ideas, which is if a patient is aware of what the cost of their care is, they might be a little more judicious in choosing what care to have. So we had a lot of defensive medicine, we still do, a lot of care that was may or may not have been necessary, medically necessary. So we deal with that in labs all the time, of course. But this combination of events, along with the fact that care became much, much better. We now have cure for hepatitis C. We have CRISPR. We have all sorts of surgical interventions. We have an incredible set of care that is helping contribute, but that care costs a lot of money. All of this together results in patients seeing a burden and resulting in challenges that ultimately lead back to Congress and staffers like me hearing it on the phone and in person, and that leads to legislation like the No Surprises Act, which is the most evident piece of the transparency rules, and we'll talk about that some more. All right, so that's how we got here. And let me give you some specifics. So surprise bills, primarily related to emergency care. You're driving along, somebody runs a stop sign, you wake up in the hospital, and you got a $65,000 airplane ride or helicopter ride that is on your bill. Now, I don't know about you, but I could probably take 10 of my friends in a G3 to New York and back for $65,000 and stay at the Ritz-Carlton. So clearly a helicopter ride for 75 miles or less should not cost that. And this may be an outlier, but it's an example. And it's these examples that are actually what drive policy. The second part of why this is important is that patients were being put in the middle between their providers and the payers. I'm a moderately intelligent, somewhat educated person who speaks English and works in healthcare, and even I have a challenge in trying to go up against a health insurance company or my providers to try and negotiate my pricing. And yet you're asking people, elderly folks who have no advocates or people who don't speak English as a first language or what have you, trying to negotiate, and of course that is not appropriate either. And laboratories are at a disadvantage. Unlike the situation where, in an emergency situation where care just happens, and then you try and deal with the outcome, laboratories is a prescriptive event. And so laboratories, they get an order in, and they are required to test what is on the order. Of course, that's designed not to add things to the order, so you're not testing for things that were in order, but it also means you have to test for the things that were, and there's cost for that. And payers aren't exactly, over time, welcoming to new labs or new technologies. It is extremely challenging, just ask Chris here, how hard it is to get a contract with the payer. So there are narrow networks, so there's very difficult to get in-network with payers. And there's a lot of innovation in lab. And so a lot of these technologies that are coming to market, these tests, are considered experimental, or they don't have pricing, they don't have coverage. And so, again, you have patients that are seeing these types of bills, and that shows up as that statistic that 10% of all surprise bills are generated out of the lab space. Now, I want to be clear. There are some small portion of bad actors that have also written the equivalent of the $65,000 helicopter ride. We had $5,000 COVID tests, as an example. So there is a need for us as an industry to be conscious and appropriate in the way we're doing our billing anyways. All right, so Rachel, let's talk more broadly about the timeline. Give us some insight here.
Okay, so looking at this timeline, it shows that Congress was actually trying to be very thoughtful in their approach to price transparency, and they passed a number of different legislative initiatives that were designed to be complementary. So you have the Transparency and Coverage Act that had the final rule passed in 2020, and that was really aimed at kind of having coverage and machine-readable files made available to the public. That followed along with the No Surprises Act, where patients were then, they needed to get good faith estimates and costs ahead of their service. And then you can go on into the machine-readable files became available in 2022. That really opened up more price transparency, so people could see what cost was going to, cost them before their healthcare services were rendered. And then we moved on to kind of advancing interoperability and improving the prior authorization process, where we have to have prior authorization processes streamlined and for all government services. So that's coming next. And then we're going to get into the lower cost, more transparency in a little bit, because that one really affects the laboratories and kind of how can you be prepared for that.
All right, so No Surprise Act passes around 2020. The rule comes out in 2022. It's partially implemented. It's immediately litigated. There was some success in that litigation. Just as an example, HHS, in proposing this final rule, said they thought there'd be about 22,000 disputes filed in the first year. And instead, between June of 21 and April 22 and June of 23, almost 500,000 disputes were filed. So we're going to talk about good faith estimates, and we'll talk about advanced EOBs in a little more detail. Those are two of the primary requirements of the law, and the independent dispute resolution organizational setup was also a huge piece, and I've already described that how the amount of disputes is overwhelming compared to what they thought it would be. And yet here we are, I just checked, and as of March, 85% of the pathology and lab disputes remain unresolved. Those that have been resolved are showing that when a payer says it should be price X, that's their qualifying payment amount, that they're resolved in lab's favors by about a 2.5 times. So this gives you an inclination, an indication that perhaps price transparency might be driving down pricing. Would you agree?
I think ideally in the future we will see it drive down pricing, having more availability of what things are going to cost and just knowing that if something is out of network, is there an in-network option? I think that will have an impact on patients.
Yeah. I mean, speaking from the lab side, I think everything drives down the cost. So.
On top of all of that, the implementation of the law is actually quite problematic and challenging. There are 18-plus states that have their own price transparency laws, and the NSA specifically says that it does not override state laws. So since labs can be from a single footprint serving a national audience, quite challenging to understand what law applies in what state. It only addresses certain services, and so there's some uncertainty as whether you're supposed to comply or not comply. The hospitals, which are these, at least fully integrated with their hospital labs, have some ability to determine what the price should be for any of the particular services that are out there, but enforcement has been really light to date. So we don't really know exactly what is truly going to be considered complying with or not complying with the NSA yet to date. And these machine-readable files are not exactly easily read by humans. They're read well by machines.
Yes.
And so there are some significant challenges and complexity to what it means. So you have users downloading these massive files and then trying to interpret them.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about good faith estimates. Rachel, why don't you give us some... What do they mean? What are they about?
I mean, they're really trying. The good faith estimate is a first step of kind of giving a patient an idea what is going to happen with them at their healthcare service appointment that they schedule. And first of all, there's a timeline that they were very, very directive. When a patient schedules a service, the healthcare service provider has 3 days that they need to provide a good faith estimate to that patient ahead of their service. And that good faith estimate requires verification of a patient's coverage. So do they have health insurance? If they don't, that's okay. So they know that they're going to be a cash pay patient. And then also it goes into a little bit about what are the contracted rates for the expected care. If I'm going for a physical, I'm going to, assume I'm going to probably have a physical workup and probably some blood work done. So what are those rates and what are the codes? So that should be provided to the patient all ahead of the time.
Okay. Any comment on the GFEs for now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's talk about the advanced EOBs.
Okay, so that is then the part two. So once you have the GFE, then that GFE is provided to the health plan. And then the health plan has another timeline, 3 days, that they need to return what is the network status for those contracted rates, what is the cost sharing. So what will the patient be expected to have to pay? What will the health plan be expected to have to pay? And then what is the deductible and the out-of-pocket and the maximums? And then is there any medical management, any prior authorizations required, any genetic counseling required? All of that should be provided ahead of time, just so there's a comprehensive view of, oh, I didn't know there was a PA required, or I didn't know that should not happen.
So what you're saying, Rachel, if I understand correctly, is I'm a patient, mm-hmm. I'm in my clinician's office, and he says, you need a test, but yep. I'm not going to be able to order it for 6 days because I can't tell you what the price is?
Well, that could happen. That could happen. I mean, there was a lot of rebuttal when this came out because what if I am in a rural setting? I don't have internet. What if there isn't anything available? So that's why Congress has been pretty prescriptive in having things patient-facing, and that is going into some of the regulations.
Yeah. All right, so a little bit deeper dive into what it means for labs. So you're supposed to have these payer portals where a consumer can go online and look at their lab tests, their suite of lab tests, and make some decisions about what to order or what to pay for. So if LabCorp is charging $6.99 for a test and Quest is charging $7.24 for that same test, that the patient should be able to choose that. And of course, I'm imagining my own common test. So am I supposed to understand whether or not, if it's starting to get expensive, do I really need an A1C? Do I really need a bilirubin, a TS? Like, I don't know what, as a patient, I need to order or not order. Or think about it in the toxicology world, which I'm a little more familiar with. So he's ordered a test to see if I'm on heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine. You could do the cocaine and the methamphetamine, but let's skip the heroin, right? So it's probably a little bit awkward if you're actually asking patients to make decisions about what types of tests they should or should not be ordered. Additionally, for these shoppable services, you're supposed to be posting your cash price and your minimum price and your maximum price. This is not exactly a very workable situation where, you know, you've got your Medicare rate, and then you negotiate a rate to be in network, and then you negotiated a really good rate with one payer and a not-so-good rate with another payer for business reasons, and now you're posting it. Now payer A is paying three times what payer B is paying. They're going to come back to you the next contract period and say, wait a minute, they're paying you far less. We should renegotiate. So you have to understand your responsibilities as a provider here. And so how does that work? So we have to determine whether or not your tests actually are required to follow NSA. And so there's a whole series of tests. Now, if it's emergency services and it's a lab test related to emergency services, it's covered. That was pretty clear in the law. Yeah. It gets a little tricky after that, however. So what is the context of the order? Like I said, if it's emergency services, yes, you've got to cover it. But what is it? What is it, a visit? And so if it's a visit, then you have to determine, well, is it a visit at an in-network facility, and is the specimen being sent off-site to another facility that is in-network? Well, in that instance, yes. If you're out-of-network, it's in-network, yes, you're supposed to comply with the NSA. But if you're being sent to a facility that is not in-network, but you're in-network, are you supposed to comply? It's obviously confusing, as I'm trying to describe how confusing it is from a lab operations point of view. You have to determine if the originating facility is in network or not. And so, given all these complexities and the fact that there is some there's a section in the law that says that if it's being sent out, then it doesn't necessarily comply. But what happens if you're a patient getting a service in a hospital, for example, and they have an in-hospital pathology lab, but they need to send it to Myriad for a genetic test, and the in-hospital pathology lab is in-network with that patient, but Myriad is not? Does the NSA apply? It's really unclear. Hence, 500,000 disputes in the IDRs. And so that's why enforcement has been spotty. And that's why all these remain. And so, by the way, just the fact that it has been so complex has really given labs, for the most part, independent labs outside the hospital setting for sure, sort of some suggestion that compliance is not really, this doesn't really apply to us for the most part. Would you agree?
I would agree that I think compliance has been improving. And I think Congress has been sending warning letters to either hospitals or laboratories for not complying. They may not be issuing a lot of fines, because you hear about the fines. That's where you get the big splash and the, you know, this hospital has been awarded, you know, a fine of $2 million. But I think we are starting to see more and more files getting released and people starting to attempt to comply.
Okay. But as you might imagine, people still complain.
Yes.
They're still getting hefty bills. And so Congress is still working on it. And so there are a number of legislative and other regulatory initiatives underway. The most evident one is this H.R. 5378, Lower Cost, More Transparency. So this bill passed the House earlier this year, but some of the sweeteners in the bill, which were funding authorizations for very popular public health programs, actually got included in what was called the minibus, which is what funded the government through the end of this fiscal year, end of August. And so some of those sweeteners getting already addressed reduced the ability or the ability for somebody to say, oh yeah, I voted for this really great thing, but yeah, something in here is tucked in a way that that you may not like. However, that being said, the Senate has had additional conversations around this, and there is some rumor discussion around the Senate actually taking up the rest of the legislation in a lame duck session after the election. Mm-hmm. So this legislation is not dead. So what does the legislation do? Well, it's primarily, from a high level, talking about PBMs. And so pharma is always a good fall guy, I guess, for the healthcare industry. And so this is really the focus. Most of the discussion is around the price, the lack of transparency in the pricing between pharmaceutical companies and PBMs in terms of rebates. But labs are included in this. And one of the biggest issue here for labs is that, remember I mentioned there were some lawsuits that proved in a court of law that the implementing rule didn't quite fit the intent of Congress? Well, the purpose of this piece on labs and other healthcare specialties is to codify the rule in the law to eliminate the ability for that lack of differentiation between what Congress intended and what HHS actually put into the rule. So if you're thinking about, oh, well, these lawsuits really gave us a really nice way to go in and win these IDR situations at 250% of the qualified payment amount, that potentially could go away should this legislation ultimately make it into law. Mm-hmm. Additionally, there's a requirement for a consumer calculator. So imagine a consumer goes onto your website and then tries to calculate the cost of their potential test. Now, again, perhaps if it's a specialty genetic test like Myriad or many in the audience today, that might be a fairly easy task. I need this test that my doctor said, and this is what it costs. But again, if you're getting a panel or what have you, and there's a bunch of CPT codes associated with it, like, good luck, consumer being able to navigate that. But that's part of the law. Mm-hmm. Any other questions on this so far? All right.
Oh, we have a question in the back.
Yes. Yeah. All right. And I think I actually covered the points I wanted to cover on here. Empowering patients is the goal. That's what moves legislation. But let's see here. Let's actually go to some of the other regulatory efforts. There we go. Okay. So as many of you probably know, for many years there was an effort to reduce the physician fee payment schedule, the MPFS, and Congress was punting it every year for, I don't know, 11, 12, 13, mm-hmm. maybe 17 years. They would not fix the fee schedule cuts that were scheduled for the physician fee schedule. And in 2015, they did do a permanent fix to the physician fee schedule, ironically coming after 2014 passage of PAMA, which put a significant cost savings on the books related to labs, helping fund the doc fix. Well, we aren't actually solved with the doc fix. Here we are again. And you can imagine that even though Medicare has reduced the physician fee schedule by a small, or if you're a doctor, large amount every year, the actual aggregate cost of care continues to rise. And so even though it may cost 2 or 3% or 1.5% less for a particular CPT or procedure, what have you, in aggregate, there's still massive pressure at the federal level and state level, of course, as well, to try and rein in those costs. So there is a reason why these types of initiatives exist to try and reduce, of course, medically unnecessary work, but also just rein in cost overall so that with the dollars that we have, we can continue to produce care. So there is last month there was a conference similar to this where a senior member of Congress said, we're going to really go at this another doc fix. There was actually a hearing earlier this month in the Senate where they again talked about a permanent doc fix. And if you go back to my comment at the very beginning, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And so labs need to be aware that if there is an effort to change what happens in behalf of the AMA and the AHA, you need to be at the table and you need to be aware that these cuts may potentially affect you. Additionally, there is a significant amount of press and discussion around consolidation in the market overall. And part of this, hospitals are going out of business, and especially rural care is going out of business. So there's a lot of consolidation as just simply a means of surviving. And that generates a lot of consternation, obviously, in terms of the quality of care, the cost of care. But even so, I just did a little math this morning. UHC, largest payer in the world, I think, besides the government, they posted $5.5 billion in profit in the quarter end for 23. Of course, they lost $1 billion thanks to change in the last quarter. But if you divide that, their $5.5 billion in bottom-line profits by the number of lives they covered, it's not actually a lot of money. It's about 50 bucks a patient per quarter in profit. And that's on about a $5,000 a year average cost of a plan. So in aggregate, it's a big number. But think about smaller plans and how are they surviving? They don't even have the efficiencies, if you can call a big bureaucracy like UHC efficient, but they don't even have the efficiencies of a very large organization to try and to get that. So there is pressure throughout the industry, and yet the FTC, the Department of Justice, HHS are all very concerned and very aware of the downside, the net negative effects associated with this industry consolidation. Additionally, the White House and others continue to be focused on the cost of prescription drugs. And we are so fortunate that the pharmaceutical industry is as innovative as it is, but due to the way that those costs are recovered today, the cost of that of these very innovative drugs falls heavily on specifically the U.S. patient base, but certainly those that are paying private payer out of pocket. And so they were successful in capping the cost of insulin as a very important and helpful means of reducing the cost of pharmaceuticals, but they aren't stopping there. They had a White House conference with a lot of folks around the room. I didn't see a lab person in the room, by the way, talking about the cost of care and what other things they could be doing about it. So there is pressure throughout, and you should be aware of this. The Biden budget that was released in February, I think it was, did have some really interesting things related to labs. There's over $1 billion designated in the budget. Of course, we haven't passed this yet, but over $1 billion for supporting the digitization, electronification, interoperability around behavioral health. Mm-hmm. And so, as you know, in primary care, in hospitals, and so on, with MIPS and other incentives. Most of the EHRs that are in the hospital space and in primary care and so on are certified health IT, but in the behavioral health space, not many. And so this will hopefully drive more of those EHRs to go to become certified health IT. Along with that, there is another $1 billion or so for opioid risk reduction and harm reduction. And again, an important public health emergency, quite frankly, that during the COVID era, it sort of fell off the newspapers, but I think 100,000 people died of overdose last year. So it continues to be an important part of our overall healthcare spectrum. So these are some of the things that might be helpful. And additionally, there's $2 billion for rural broadband. So back to your earlier point about how do we comply. So there are some good things potentially in the budget that are proposed. But the point of this conversation, again, to go back to my earlier statement, is to be aware of these things, to be involved, and to stay on top of it. All right. So enough talking from the talking heads here. Let's actually talk to the guy who knows how to operate and does operate. Let's turn it over to Chris.
Thanks, Greg. So, you know, my role here was to talk a little bit about, you know, how do labs operate and how do they implement things like no surprises. And I'll tell you, it's been incredibly challenging to implement no surprises for a couple of reasons. You know, the first is, you know, the goal was really on the billing side to prevent surprise billing. You know, at least at our laboratory, we don't do balance billing. And so the number of actual surprise bills where a patient received a bill for $500, $1,000 are incredibly small, well under like 1%. We're only billing the in-network coinsurance and deductibles. That's the sort of standard practice that we have. The goal, really, in no surprises, was to allow patients to have that information up front. As we heard earlier, that's really challenging when we don't get the order until potentially a day after that patient has come into the physician's laboratory. So meeting that sort of 3-day good faith estimate has been a challenge. We've had to go to text messages and emails where we're sending out to patients what their expected out-of-pocket cost will be, and then having to honor that responsibility that we sent them in spite of the fact that we find out they had the wrong insurance, they didn't share that insurance with us, or that the patient hasn't quite met their total deductible, and so it's a little bit larger than we had anticipated. So that's one of the things that's been a real challenge in trying to honor that good faith estimate. And then finally, the sort of dispute resolution process, we were hopeful that this would bring the payers to the table, especially those that have not wanted to bring our laboratory in-network. But we're finding out really two things. First, because it's really limited to those tests where the ordering physician is in a facility that is in-network, and then the laboratory is out-of-network, for us that's very difficult. I don't know how your orders come in. We still have, unfortunately, a lot of paper. That paper comes in as Dr. Jones from da-da-da-da-da and Associates. We don't know whether da-da-da-da-da and Associates is actually part of a in-network facility or not. Is that a physician office? Is that a hospital outpatient facility that's being guised as a physician office? Is that coming from Ochsner Clinic? They don't always put the facility of where they are located in if they are located in a facility, which would make it eligible for no surprises. So we're sort of in that, do we know whether or not Dr. Jones is or is not in an in-network facility when the insurance the patient has happens to be out-of-network for us? And then when we do find out and we want to go through the independent dispute resolution, there's a 30-day sort of negotiation period. Even though, you know, Myriad has been around a long time, when we send messages to our contacts about engaging in the independent dispute resolution, they ask us if we are MIRAD, who are we? We're not familiar with your laboratory or testing. And so we get into this sort of 30 days of we send things, nothing comes back, and they claim they don't understand the independent dispute resolution process. And so we sort of get into this vicious cycle, and we're stuck in the, as Greg said, the 85% of sort of IDR claims that ultimately sort of sit and have not been adjudicated in any way. So we were hopeful that this would get payers to the table to start talking about negotiation, bringing laboratories like ours in network, and we haven't found that to be the case. You know, the last is, you know, we want to talk a little bit about just the price transparency and how that impacts, you know, laboratories. You know, the current state right now is that the payers are responsible for publishing their in-network rate for all covered services. And those rates must be made available on a tool that a patient can go to on their website to shop for those services. That seems to make some sense, as Greg talked about, if you're a patient and you know that you're getting a laboratory test. Therein lies some of the challenge. Do you know what laboratory test you are getting before you walk into that physician's office? Some may not. But at least with the payers putting that on the website, a patient has an opportunity, to use Greg's example, of being able to say, hey, LabCorp will do this for $6.99, Quest will do it for $7.20. I want it to go to LabCorp because I'm going to pay that $6.99. As we get into, you know, the discussions about future laws and potentially including laboratories in that equation and having laboratories have to publish their rates, both a maximum and a minimum, how does a patient shop for those services? Because what I would be putting on my website is, I gave AmeriHealth this rate for this test. I gave United this rate for this test. They can't shop the insurance company. They already have their insurance. So how does putting the maximum contracted rate and minimum contracted rate for a single service for a laboratory help the patient actually shop for that service? Because really what they'd be shopping for is an insurance company, which is something they can't necessarily do but once a year. And if their employer is sponsoring their insurance, they really can't shop at all. And I think we're fearful as we, you know, face that potential challenge in sort of potential legislation, how that will impact our ability to negotiate. It's great to have the information as we're negotiating with payers and being able to talk to payers about, hey, you gave this rate for this test to this laboratory. You're pleading poverty to us and saying we want to give you, you know, we want to give you 80% of the CLFS or 60% of the CLFS or whatever it might be, yet we know that they gave labs A, B, and C something significantly more. That is helpful. But just in the same way, if we were forced to publish our rates of what we contracted for, we know that payers will most definitely use that against us in their rate negotiations. And I know Greg said United's only making $50 per member, but boy, would I love to make $50 in profit for every patient test that I get to run, because that is not happening in our laboratory. I don't know in other laboratories that that might be happening, but we consistently face challenges in getting reimbursement and getting fair reimbursement for the services we're providing, and $50 in profit per patient would seem like a would seem blissful to me and my leadership and my organization. So I think there's some real challenges both in operationalizing No Surprises, but I think there's some real challenges on the way if some of the transparency things come to laboratories, as we are always under rate pressures. I don't know about you guys, but you know, inflation works in Utah just like it does everywhere else, and so our costs are going up. But I don't remember the last negotiation I went to with a payer where they started with an increase in my rate. It has never happened in my 20-some years of negotiating with the payers where they've said, hey, we want to pay you as a starting fee 5% more than what our last contract is. It is always starting at a cut. So in spite of the innovation, in spite of, you know, what we're doing to try to bring solutions to payers and their members, we're constantly under these rate pressures. And so we're fearful about what continued in the lab transparency might bring when there really isn't any benefit to the member in being able to shop the, those services in the way that Congress, I think, intends.
It's a pretty powerful conversation there, Chris. Rachel, do you want to add anything to that before we jump on to how labs might attempt to comply?
I mean, I think I agree with what, you know, Chris has been saying here, because the goal is to, I mean, we're not picking on any one industry. We want to have price transparency out there. And then the health plans, you know, they're publishing their massive files out there, and then having a healthcare service provider have to deal with that, there is some inherent challenges.
Yeah. Okay, well, we have just a few minutes left, so how do we make it work?
All right. So again, we're not picking on anyone, and I'm going to talk through a little bit of kind of our journey and what we've been doing. So this first example here is an example of a shoppable service table. And this is out on the website. You know, right now you can go find this. This was actually Albany Med Health System, which was graded an A+ in terms of complying with the legislation. So if we want to take a look at this spreadsheet, this is not very helpful. I mean, there's a whole lot of prices here. I mean, I had to cut it off at the B's, and it just it went on and on and on. And you can see all the pricing there, and this is for, you know, lab testing. But this does kind of meet some of the requirements there. So this is an example. This next one is a CMT worksheet that we implemented back in 2019. One of our customers or one of our clients is like, can you provide any kind of benefits investigation, price transparency to the patient so they know what it's going to cost? And we, you know, we designed this spreadsheet. We, you know, kind of made it work to fit this test. And, you know, you can see here it has, you know, the ID. It has the, you know, the accumulators on here. It has a little bit of the information. But I can tell you this did not work for very long. Carrie can attest to that. Leah, I think you're very familiar with this one. But, you know, the complexity that was required to make this work to give accurate pricing, you just couldn't do it on an Excel spreadsheet. Version control was an issue, but it did, you know, work. So if you're thinking about, hey, can I do something myself? Yes. You know, this is, you can easily customizable. So that is something that is definitely there. This next example is one of my favorites. This is a hospital system in Florida, and they built a beautiful patient-facing tool. It is amazing. You can go on there. You can put in what you're going to have done. Where it's going to be, and then it will spit out kind of where you should go and what the cost will be. The problem is that they have an entire team working on this. So what usually happens is the patient will go online, find it, and then they're going to call. And it's going to, then someone's going to walk them through it. But, this is, and they've had great success with this because this has aided in brand loyalty. And then it's also, it gives kind of the clear data. So this is an example. It is probably prohibitively expensive, though, to build and maintain if you're looking at from a cost-benefit standpoint. And so on the CareVizo path, we really have been trying to merge kind of price transparency along into the physician office, because we find that when this is done in the physician office, the patient is able to have that conversation with their healthcare service provider about what is going to happen and a little bit of the understanding. So you can have the healthcare service provider say, okay, we need to have this test done, and I would like to choose lab A because of the quality and I know this testing. And let's go and see what that cost is going to be, with your health insurance. And, oh, good news, it's going to be in-network, and so, that will work with your health plan. Or if it's going to be out-of-network, is there another alternative that the physician feels comfortable, recommending to the patient? Or is it just going to be a conversation like, okay, it's going to be out-of-network, let's see what the cost will be? And so all of that can happen ahead of time before the test is even ordered, so the patient feels more comfortable with kind of their healthcare journey, that they're listening to their healthcare provider. I know when I go to the doctor's office, I'm going to 99% of the time do what they recommend. So that is really the ideal workflow that we see, is that happens there at the point of care, and the patient is informed, and this complies with the regulations.
So I heard Chris say, I believe, hopefully I'm not misattributing, at another conference, that we as a lab industry have told doctors that we're just going to make it easy for them. And I hope that was you that said that. It was? Okay, good. I wasn't misquoting you. So Chris said, and we as a lab industry, we're very competitive in trying to win the business. And so, hey, doc, it's super easy to order from us. We're going to do everything for you. And so we've trained doctors when it comes to labs to really put the burden of effort on the labs, as opposed to where in their own office, they do the work for their own reimbursement requirements within the office for themselves. And what Rachel is talking about, you're Carrie, you're Rachel, and what we're interested in is trying to provide as much information to the clinician to make it easier to comply and be supportive and support their patients as possible, and to automate as much of that process as possible, so that labs can go into those doctors' offices and say, look, it's not going to be easy, but we're making it as easy as possible for you to provide the types of services to these patients that they need without overburdening you any more than you're already overburdened. And so that's what sort of the takeaway is that anytime you can move downstream workload to the front of the process in as efficient a way as possible, it provides an ability to not only comply with the law, but also provide a much better outcome for you as a lab. And I think that's our primary takeaway for today. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Anything else you want to add before we, with our very few minutes left, open up for questions? All right.
Nope.
Questions from the audience. There's a question.
So Chris, from your perspective, since BRCA, there's other tests that are under ACA that require no cost share. How do you determine that on a new pay test?
So, I'm getting a stop. So I will answer. I will answer that question in the app.
All right. Well, thanks everybody. It looks like we have run out of time. Thank you. Really appreciate you being here. Thank you for your attention.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.